all hips and back and bared throat. The collar gleamed against her skin. Cord sat over her, petting the woman like an overexcited animal. In a few moments she was making soft, cooing sounds, curling toward him like a sleepy kitten.
"There," he stood up and said casually. "That's a good girl."
Odiana's eyes flew open wide, then fluttered slowly closed again. She gasped, clutching her arms to her chest as though to hold something in, and for perhaps half a minute she writhed that way, letting out soft moans of unmistakable pleasure. Cord smiled. He looked at Asana and said quietly,
"Stupid little whore."
Odiana's body convulsed, back abruptly arching into a bow. She let out another scream, this one thin, high, somehow sickened, and flung herself onto her side. She retched violently, though there was little enough content in her stomach to come up onto the dusty floor. Her legs and arms jerked in frantic spasm, and she lifted huge, desperate eyes to Asana, her expression agonized, pleading. She reached toward the collar at her throat and spasmed again, more violently, thrashing and flailing and rolling dangerously close to the circle of coals. Asana stared at the woman in horrified confusion for a breath before she lurched forward, unsteady herself, and caught Odiana before she could convulse into the ring of coals.
"Stop it!"
Asana cried. She looked back at Cord, knew that her face was pale and desperately afraid, and saw the glitter of satisfaction in his expression when she turned to him.
"Stop it! You're killing her!"
"Might be kinder," Cord said. "She's been broken before."
But to Odiana he said, voice smug,
"Good girl. Stay here and you'll be a good girl. Do what you're told."
The frantic spasms eased out of the woman very slowly. Asana drew her back away from the coals and kept her arms around her, her body between Odiana and Cord. The woman's eyes had lost focus again, and she shuddered in slow waves in Isana's arms.
"What did you do to her?" Asana asked quietly.
Cord turned and walked toward the door.
"What you need to learn is that slaves are just animals. You train an animal by providing rewards and punishments. Rewarding good behavior, punishing bad. That's how you turn a wild horse into an obedient mount. How you train a wolf into a hunting hound."
He opened the door and said casually,
"Same with slaves. You're just more animals. To be used for labor, breeding, whatever. You just have to be trained."
Cord left the smokehouse, but his words drifted back to them.
"Arik, build up the fire. Asana, you'll wear one tomorrow. Think about that."
Asana said nothing, stunned by what she had seen, by Odiana's reaction to the sight of the collar, to her condition now. Asana looked down at her and brushed some of the dark, tangled hair from her eyes.
"Are you all right?"
The woman looked up at her, eyes heavy and languid, and shivered.
"It's good now. It's good. I'm good now."
Asana swallowed. "He hurt you before, when he called you..." She didn't say the words.
"Hurts," Odiana whispered. "Yes. Oh, crows and furies. So much hurt. I'd forgotten how bad it was."
She shivered again.
"How good it was."
She opened her eyes, and again they were wet with tears.
"They can change you. You can fight and fight, but they change you. Make you happy to be what they want. Make it hurt when you try to resist. You change, old girl. He can do it to you. He can make you beg him to take you, to touch you, make you..."
She turned her face away, though her body was still racked with the long, shivering shudders of pleasure, and turned her face from Asana.
"Please, please kill me before he comes back. I can't be that again. I can't go back."
"Shh,"
Asana said, rocking the woman gently.
"Shh,
Rest. You should sleep.
Please,
she whispered, but her face had already gone slack. Her body begun to sag.
Please.
She shuddered once more and then went completely limp, her head falling to one side. Isana laid the woman down as gently as she could. She knelt over her, testing her pulse, putting a hand to her forehead. Her heart still beat too quickly and her skin felt fevered, dry. Isana looked up, to where Arik stood next to a hod for coal, watching her. When she looked up at him, he ducked his head, turning to the hod, and began to dump coals into a bucket beside it. She needs water, Isana said quietly. After all of that. She needs water, or she'll die in this heat. Arik looked at her again. He picked up the bucket and, without speaking, walked to one side of the ring and started shaking fresh coals out of it and into the fire. Isana ground her teeth with frustration. If she was only able to listen, she might be able to gain important insight. The boy seemed reluctant to follow his father's commands. He might be convinced to help them, if only she could find the right words to say. She felt blind, crippled. Arik, listen to me, Isana said. You can't possibly think he's going to get away with this. You can't possibly think that he will escape justice for what happened tonight. He finished dumping out the bucket. He walked back to the hod, his voice toneless. He's escaped it for years. What do you think happens to every slave who comes through here? Isana stared at him for a moment, sickened. Crows, she whispered. Arik, please, at least help me get this collar off. She reached down to Odiana's throat, turning the collar about and trying to find the clasp. Don't, Arik said, his voice quick, harsh. Don't, you'll kill her. Isana's fingers froze. She looked up at him. Arik chewed on his lip. Then he said, Pa's blood is on it. He's the only one can take it off her. How can I help her? You can't, Arik said, his voice frustrated. He turned and threw the bucket at the wall of the smokehouse. It clattered against it and fell to the floor. He leaned his hands against the wall and bowed his head. You can't help her. The way he's left her, anyone can tell her anything, and she'll keep feeling good as long as she does it. She tries to resist and she'll... and it will hurt her.
That's inhuman, Isana said. Great furies, Arik. How can you let this happen?
Shut up, he said. Just you shut up.
Motions stiff, angry, he pushed off the wall and recovered the bucket and started filling it with coal again.
You were right, you know, Isana said, keeping her voice quiet. I was telling the truth. So was Tavi, if he told you that the valley was in danger, that the Marat may be coming again. It could happen soon. It could have begun already. Arik, please listen to me.
He dumped more coal out onto the fires and returned to gather up more.
You have to get word out. For your own sake, if not for ours. If the Marat come, they'll kill everyone of Cordhold too.
You're lying, he told her, not looking at her. You're just lying, trying to save your hide.
I'm not, Isana said. Arik, you've known me your whole life. When that tree fell on you that winter fair, I helped you. I helped everyone in the valley who needed it, and I never asked for anything in return.
Arik added more coal to the fire.
How can you be a part of this? She demanded. You aren't stupid, Arik. How can you do this to other Alarans?
How can I not? Arik said, voice cold. This is all I have. I don't have a happy steadholt where people take care of each other. I have this. Men who no one else would take live here. Women who no one would want to be. He's my blood. Bitant,
he broke off and swallowed.
He was my blood, too. As stupid and mean as he could be, he was my brother.
I'm sorry, Isana said, and found that she felt it. I never wanted anyone to get hurt. I hope you know that.
I know, Arik said. You heard what happened to Hedy, and you wanted what was right to happen. To keep her safe, and girls like her. Crows know they need it with Pa around like some...
He shook his head. Isana fell silent for a long moment, staring at the young man, an understanding dawning on her. Then she said quietly, "It wasn't Bitan that was with Hedi. It was you, Arik." He didn't look at her. He didn't speak. "It was you. That's why she was trying to draw her father back from Juris Macto with yours. She wasn't raped."
Arik rubbed at the back of his neck. We liked each other. Got together when there was a meet or a fair. Her little brother found us. Too young to know what he saw. I got out before he seen who I was. But he went running to her father, and how could she tell him she'd been making time with one of Kord's sons?
He spat the words with disgust.
She didn't say much, I guess, and her old man made up his own mind what happened.
"Oh, Furies," Isana said sadly. "Arik, why didn't you say anything?"
"Say what?" Arik said, flicking a hard glance at her. "Tell my father that I loved a girl and wanted to marry her? Bring her here?"
He gestured around the smokehouse with one hand.
"Or maybe I should have been all honorable and went to her father. Do you think he would have listened to me? Do you think for a second Warner wouldn't have strangled me where I stood?"
Isana rubbed a shaking hand at her eyes. "I'm sorry, Arik, I'm sorry. We've all known that your father was... that he'd gone too far. But we didn't do anything. We didn't know things were this bad at his Steadholt."
"Too late for all of that now."
Arik dropped the bucket and headed for the door.
"It's not," Isana said. "Wait! Just listen to me, Arik, please!"
He stopped, his back still to her.
"You know him," she said. "He'll kill us. But if you help us get out, I'll help you, I swear by all the Furies. I'll help you get away if you want to. I'll help you settle things with Warner. If you do love the girl, you might be able to be with her if you do the right thing."
"Help both of you? That woman was trying to kill you last night."
He looked back at her.
"Why would you help her?"
"I wouldn't leave any woman here, Arik," Isana said, voice quiet, calm.
"I wouldn't leave anyone to him. Not anymore. I won't let him keep doing this." "You can't stop him," Arik's voice was tired. "You can't. Not here. He's a citizen."
"That's right. And so is my brother. Bernard will call him to Juris Macto. And he'll win, too, we both know that."
She stood up, facing Arik, and lifted her chin.
"Break the circle. Bring me water. Help us escape."
There was silence for a long moment.
"He'd kill me," Arik said then, his voice numb. "He's said so before. I believe him. Bitan was his favorite. He'd kill me, and he'd get the whole story, and he'd get Hedi, too."
"Not if we stop him. Arik, it doesn't have to be this way. Help me. Let me help you."
"I can't," he said.
He looked back at her and said quietly,
"Isana, I can't. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for you and for that girl. But he's my only blood. He's a monster. But he's all I have."
The young man turned and left, shutting the door to the smokehouse behind him. Isana heard several heavy bolts sliding shut on the outside. Thunder rumbled somewhere in the distance, a growling, sleepy leftover of the previous night's tempest. Inside the smokehouse, the coals popped and simmered. Odiana breathed slowly, quietly. Isana bowed her head, staring at the woman, at the collar about her throat. She remembered Odiana's frantic pleas to kill her. Isana lifted her hand to her own throat and shivered. Then she sank back to the ground, her head bowed. Chapter 29. Amara's ankle burned and ached, and she fought to keep her labored breathing from turning into a panting gasp. Bernard, running through the ice and snow-covered trees several yards ahead of her, reached a small rise and vanished down the other side. She followed him, stumbling at the last pace, and threw herself into the ditch behind the little rise with a crunching of snow and frozen leaves. Bernard put his hand on her back, steadying her, and lifted a hand to hold it in front of her mouth and block the wisps of vapor escaping with each exhalation. His eyes went distant, and then she felt him pull the veil over them. Shadows shifted and changed in subtle patterns over her skin as the trees around them sighed and rustled as though in a wind. The frozen brush did not seem to move so much as to have simply grown into a screen over them, and the sudden scent of earth and crushed plants flooded over them, veiling even that much evidence of their presence. Only a few seconds later they heard hoof-falls in the forest behind them, and Amara moved enough to peer over the rise at the direction in which they'd come. "Won't they see our tracks?" she whispered in a rough gasp of breath. Bernard shook his head, his face drawn, weary.
"No," he whispered. "Trees lost some leaves in some places. Grass stirred enough to move the snow in others. And it's all ice, sleet. Shadows are helping hide more."
Amara sank slowly back down behind the rise, frowning at him. "Are you all right?"
"Tired," he said, and closed his eyes. "They're knights. Their furies are on unfamiliar ground, but they're strong, starting to have trouble misdirecting them."
"Fidelius has pulled out all the stops if he's started a general hunt for us. That means he'll accelerate the plans for attack as well. How close are we to garrison?"
"Few hundred yards to the edge of the trees," Bernard said. "Then half a mile of open ground. Anything at this end of the valley will be able to see us."
"Can you earth-wave us across it?"
Bernard shook his head. "Tired."
"Can we run it?"
"Not with your leg," Bernard said. "And with them mounted, they'd just ride us down and spit us."
Amara nodded and waited until the sound of the riders had drifted away from them, off in another direction. "Half a mile. If it comes to that, I might be able to carry us. Those riders are using earth furies, yes?"
Bernard nodded. "Some would.
Either way, we'll be away from them in the open and in the air."
"And if they have Knight's Heiress with them?"
"I'll just have to be faster," Amara said. She squinted up. "I still haven't seen anyone. It would be a strain to hold position overhead with so little wind unless they were so high in the air that the clouds were giving them cover, and that would hide us as well." Bernard shivered and touched the ground with one hand.
"Hold on."
His voice had a strange note to it, and he let his breath out again a moment later with a low groan in it.
"They're close. We can't stay here any longer. The earth is too hard. Difficult to hide us."
"I'm ready," Amara said. Bernard nodded, opening his eyes, his face set in lines of grim and weary determination. They rose and headed through the woods. It only took a few moments to get to the end of the trees and to the open ground that led up to garrison. The place was a fortress. There, two of the mountains that rose up all around them fell together into an enormous V. At the point of the valley between them lay the grim grey walls of garrison, stretching across the mouth of the valley and blocking entry into it from the lands beyond with expansive, grim efficiency. The wall stretched across the mouth of the valley from the Marat lands beyond, 20 feet high and nearly as thick, all of smooth grey stone, its walls surmounted by parapets and crenellation. The gleaming forms of armoured legionaries stood at regular posts along the wall, draped in cloaks of scarlet and gold, the colours of the High Lord of Riva. Behind the wall stood the rest of garrison, a blocky fortress laid out in a legion square with 10-foot walls, a marching camp constructed of stone rather than of wood and earth. Fewer guards stood on the walls there, though they were not absent. Outbuildings had grown up around the outside of garrison, impermanent and slapdash structures that nonetheless had somehow managed to acquire the air of solidity that accompanied a small town. The rear gates of garrison stood open, and the causeway wound across the valley and up to them. People drifted around, walking briskly from building to building, and moving in and out of the gates to the camp proper. Children scampered around in the ice and snow, playing as they always did. Amara could see dogs, horses, a pen of sheep, and the smoke of dozens of fires. "There's the gate," she said.
"Right," said Bernard.
We head for that. I know the men stationed out here for the most part. We shouldn't have any trouble getting to Graham. Just remember, be polite and respectful.
All right, Amara said, impatient.
I mean it, Bernard said. Graham's got a quick temper, and he's more than capable of tossing us into holding cells until he cools off. Don't test him.
I won't, Amara said. Can you tell if they're getting any closer to us?
Bernard shook his head, grimacing.
Then we go across. Keep your eyes open, and if you see anyone coming, we'll get into the air.
Amara glanced across the plain and swept her eyes across the sky one last time, winced as she put weight on her injured ankle, and started off toward Garrison at a limping lope. Bernard shuffled along several paces behind her, his footsteps heavy. The run seemed to take forever, and Amara nearly twisted her ankle again more than once as she turned her head this way and that, watching for pursuit. But for all their fear of being ridden down in the open ground, they reached the outbuildings and then the guarded gates to Garrison itself without incident. A pair of young legionaries stood on guard at the gates, their expressions bored, heavy cloaks worn against the cold, spears held negligently in gloved hands. One of them was unshaven, strictly against legion regulations, Amara knew, and the other wore a cloak that did not seem to be of standard legion issue either, its fabric finer, its colours unmatched.
"Hold,"
said the unshaven guard in a flat tone.
"State your name and purpose of your visit."
Amara deferred to Bernard, glancing back at the steadholder. Bernard frowned at the two men.
"Where is Centurion Giraldi?"
The one in the cloak gave Bernard a blank look.
"Hey," he said, "clodhopper, in case you didn't notice, we're the soldiers here." "And citizens,"
put in the other in a surly tone.
"And citizens," the guard in the fine cloak said. "So we'll ask the questions, if that's all right with you. State your name and the purpose of your visit."
Bernard narrowed his eyes.
"I suppose you boys are new to the valley. I am Steadholder Bernard, and I am here to see Count Graham."
Both soldiers broke out in snickers.
"Yes, well," the unshaven one said, "the Count is a busy man. He doesn't have time for visiting with every scruffy clodhopper about every little problem that comes up."
Bernard took a deep breath.
"I understand that," he said. "Nonetheless, I am well within my rights to request to see him immediately on a matter of urgency to his holdings."
The unshaven guard shrugged.
"You aren't a citizen, clodhopper. You don't have any rights that I know of."
Amara's temper flashed, her patience evaporating.
"We do not have time for this," she snapped.
She turned to the guard in the fine cloak and said, "Garrison could be in danger of attack. We need to warn Graham about it and let him react as he thinks fit."
The guards glanced at each other and then at Amara.
"Look at that," the unshaven one drawled. "A girl, and here I thought that was just a skinny boy."
His partner leered.
"I suppose we could always take off those breeches and find out."
Bernard narrowed his eyes. The steadholder's fist lashed out, and the young legionary in the fine cloak landed in a senseless sprawl on the snow. His unshaven partner blinked down at the unconscious young man and then up at Bernard. He reached for his spear, but Bernard spoke sharply and the weapon's haft bowed, then straightened again, writhing out of the guard's reach and bounding away. The guard let out a short shriek and reached for his dagger. Bernard stepped close to the young man and clutched his wrist, holding his hand at his belt.
"Son, don't be stupid. You'd best go get your superior officer." "You can't do that," the guard sputtered. "I'll throw you in irons." "I just did it," Bernard said. "And if you don't want me to do it again, you'll go get your centurion."
Then he gave the young man a stiff shove, sending him clattering backwards and falling into the snow at the base of the wall. The guards swallowed and then bolted, running inside. Amara looked from the guard in the snow to Bernard and asked, "Polite and respectful, eh?" Bernard's face flushed.
"They might be spoiled city boys, but they're legion by the Furies. They should treat women with more respect."
He rubbed at his hair.
And show more respect to a steadholder, I suppose.
Amara smiled, but didn't say anything. Bernard flushed even brighter and coughed, looking away. The unshaven guard emerged from the guardhouse with a half-dressed centurion, a young man little older than him. The centurion blinked stupidly at Bernard for a minute, then gave the guard a terse order before stumbling back into the guardhouse to march off a moment later, still only half-dressed. Several legionaries gathered around the gate, and to Bernard's relief he recognized a few of the men from previous visits to garrison. A few moments later, a grizzled old man dressed in a civilian tunic but with the bearing and mien of a soldier came walking briskly out of the gates, wisps of white hair drifting around his bald pate.
"Steadholder Bernard," he said critically, eyeing the steadholder. "We don't look so good."
He made no particular comment about the condition of the guard lying in the snow, leaning down to rest his fingertips lightly on the young man's temples.
"Hela Haga," Bernard responded. "Did I hit him too hard?"
"Can't hit a head that thick too hard," Haga muttered,
then cackled.
"Oh, he'll have a headache when he wakes up. I've been waiting for this to happen."
"New recruits?"
Haga stood up and paid little further attention to the young guard in the snow.
"The better part of 2 whole cohorts down from Riva herself. Citizens' sons, almost all of them. Not enough sense to carry salt in a storm among the whole lot."
Bernard grimaced.
"I need to get to Graham. Fast, Haga."
Haga frowned, tilting his head to one side and studying Bernard.
"What's happened?"
"Get me to Graham," Bernard said.
Haga shook his head.
"Graham's been indisposed."
Amara blinked. "He's sick?" Haga snorted.
"Sick of rich boys who expect to be treated like invalids instead of legionaries, maybe."
He shook his head.
"You'll have to talk to his truth finder, Bernard." "Olivia? Get her on down here." "No," Haga said and grimaced. "Livy's youngest came to term and she went back to Riva to help with the birth. Now we've got..."
"Centurion," bawled a high nasal voice. "What's going on down here? Who is in charge of this gate? What foolishness is this?"
Haga rolled his eyes.
"We've got Pluvius Pentius instead. Good luck, Bernard."
Haga stooped down and scooped up the unconscious young legionare, tossing him over one shoulder with a grunt, and then headed back inside the fort. Pluvius Pentius turned out to be a slight young man with watery blue eyes and a decided overbite. He wore the crimson and gold of a Reaven officer, though his uniform tended to sag around the shoulders and stretched a bit over the belly. The officer slouched toward them through the snow, squinting in disapproval.
"Now see here," Pluvius said. "I don't know who you people are, but assaulting a soldier on duty is a realm offence."
He drew a sheaf of papers from his tunic and peered at them, flipping through several pages. Then he turned and looked around him.
"Yes, here it is, a realm offence. Centurion, arrest both of them and see them to the holding cells."
"Excuse me," Bernard interrupted, "but there's a more important matter at hand, sir. I'm Steadholder Bernard, and it is vital that I speak to Count Graham at once."
Pluvius blinked up at them.
"Excuse me?"
Bernard repeated himself. Pluvius frowned.
"Highly irregular."
He consulted his pages again.
"No, I don't think the Count is receiving petitions today. He holds a regular court every week, and all such matters are to be presented to him then, and in writing at least 3 days ahead of time."
"There's no time for that," Bernard blurted. "It's vital to the safety of this valley that we speak to him at once. You are his truth-finder, aren't you? Surely you can tell that we're being honest with you."
Pluvius froze, peering up at Amara over the pages. He looked from her to Bernard and back.
"Are you challenging my authority here, farmer? I assure you that I'm fully qualified and can..."
Amara flashed Bernard a warning glance.
"Sir, please. We just need to see Graham."
Pluvius drew himself up stiffly, his lips pressed together.
"Impossible,"
he stated flatly.
Court is 2 days hence, but we have not received a written petition to be filed for that date. Therefore, you will have to submit your petition to me in, let's say, no more than 6 days' time in order to be received by the Count at next week's court, and that is a matter entirely separate from an assault upon a legionare, and a citizen at that. Centurion, take them into custody.
An older soldier with several younger legionaries behind him stepped forward toward Bernard.
Sir, under the authority vested in me by my rank and at the order of my commanding officer, I place you under arrest. Please surrender your weapons and cease and desist any current fury craftings and accompany me to the holding cells where you will be incarcerated and your case brought before the Count.
Bernard growled and set his jaw.
Fine, he said, and flexed his fists. Have it your way. Maybe a few more broken heads will get me to see Graham that much faster.
The legionaries came toward Bernard, but the centurion hesitated, frowning.
Steadholder, he said carefully. This shouldn't have to get ugly.
Clovis rolled his eyes.
Centurion, arrest this man and his companion. You have no idea how much paperwork I have to do already. My time is precious.
Bernard, Amara said and laid a hand on his shoulder. Wait. Bernard faced the oncoming soldiers, his brow darkening, and the ground let out a faint tremble. The soldiers stopped in their tracks, their expressions nervous.
Come on, the big steadholder growled. I haven't got all day. Get out of my way,
thundered a voice from within the gates. Amara blinked, startled at the tone. A man in a rumpled and wine-stained shirt thrust his way through the crowd, watching the altercation. He wasn't tall, but had a barrel for a chest, and a jaw that looked heavy and hard enough to break stones upon, covered by a curling beard of fiery red. His hair, shorn short, was of a similar colour, though patchy with batches of grey that made his scalp look like a battleground, with troops in scarlet, struggling to hold terrain against a grey-clad foe. His eyes were deep under heavy brows, bloodshot and angry. He walked barefoot in the snow, and steam curled up from his footprints.
"What in the name of all the furies is going on here?"
he demanded, voice booming.
"Bernard, Flame and Thunder Man, what the crows do you think you're doing to my garrison?"
"Who?" said Clovis, his pages fluttering nervously. "Sir, I didn't know you were out of bed yet. That is, sir, I didn't know that you'd be up today. I was just taking care of this for you."
The man came to a swaying halt, and planted his fists on his hips. He glared at Clovis and then at Bernard.
"Haga woke me out of a perfectly good stupor for this," he snapped. "So it had better be good."
"Yes, sir, I'm sure. That is..."
Clovis waved a hand at the centurion. "Arrest them. Go on now. You heard the Count."
"I didn't say to arrest anyone," growled Count Graham testily.
He squinted at Bernard and then at Amara, his gaze sharp, penetrating, for all his bawling and staggering.
"Did you get yourself another woman, Bernard? Crows, it's about time. I've always said there's nothing wrong with you that a good romp or two wouldn't take care of."
Amara felt her cheeks flush with warmth.
"No, sir," she said. "It's not that. The Steadholder helped to see me safely here so that I could warn you."
"Highly irregular,"
Clovis stuttered to Graham. Pages fluttering.
Graham irritably took the pages from Clovis's hand and said,
"Quit waving these under my nose!"
There was a bright flash of light and heat, and then fine black ashes drifted away on the cool wind. Clovis let out a little yelp of distress.
"Now then," Graham said, dusting his hands, "warn me. Warn me about what?" "The Marat,"
Bernard said.
"They're on the move, sir. I think they're coming here."
Graham grunted. He jerked his chin at Amara.
"And who are you?"
"Cursor Amara, sir."
Amara felt herself lift her chin and met Graham's bloodshot gaze squarely without flinching.
"Cursor,"
Graham muttered. He glared at Clovis.
"You were going to arrest one of the First Lord's cursors?"
Clovis stammered.
One of my steadholders? Plouvis stuttered. Bah! Growled Graham. Ninny! Bring the garrison to full alert, recall all soldiers on leave, and instruct every man to get into his armor and fighting gear now!
Plouvis stared, but Graham had already swept back around to Bernard.
How bad are you thinking it's going to be?
Send word to Reva, Bernard said quietly.
Graham clenched his jaw.
You want me to call for a full mobilization? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Do you know what kind of fire is going to fall on my ears if you're wrong?
Bernard nodded.
Graham growled.
Scouts. Deploy scouts and reconnaissance into the wilderness and make immediate contact with our watchtowers.
Yes, sir, Plouvis said.
Graham stared at him for a second, then roared,
Now!
Plouvis jumped, and then turned to the nearest soldier and started repeating versions of Graham's orders. Graham rounded on Bernard.
Now then, I think you'd better explain what kind of idiot you are, hitting one of my soldiers.
A gliding caress of cold air slid over the back of Amara's neck and made her shiver, a warning from Cirrus. She glanced behind her, out toward the blinding white of pale sunlight on snow and ice. She shaded her eyes, but saw nothing. Cirrus stirred against her again. Another warning. Amara took a slow breath, focusing on the area behind them. She almost didn't see through the veil. There, perhaps no more than 10 feet away, was a disturbance in the air, several feet off the ground. A rippling dance of light, like waves rising from a sun-heated stone. Her breath caught in her throat, and she sent Cirrus out toward the disturbance with a whispered command. Her fury encountered a globe of dense air, changed to bend light, much as she herself used it to view things from afar in greater clarity. Amara took a breath, and then forced Cirrus against the globe, sudden and quick. There was a whoosh of expanding air as she dispersed the globe, and abruptly 3 men in armor with drawn swords appeared, hovering in the air. Amara cried out, and the men, their expressions startled, hesitated for a faltering second before acting. One flicked himself through the air toward her, sword gleaming. Amara threw herself to one side, sweeping her hands at the man to direct Cirrus. A roar of sudden wind washed up against her attacker's flank, shoving him wide of her, guiding his course into one of Garrison's stone walls. The man tried to slow his advance but collided hard with the wall and dropped the blade in the impact. The second of the men, expression cool, calm, thrust his hands forward, and a gale rose up immediately before the gates of Garrison, whirling snow and chips of ice into the air in a stinging cloud and hurling legionaries from their feet, driving them behind the gates for shelter. The third took his sword in hand and shot toward Bernard's back. Amara tried to cry out a warning, but Bernard's fatigue perhaps had made him too slow. He turned and tried to dodge to one side, but snow and ice betrayed his footing and he fell. Graham stepped in the way. The flame-haired count jerked the sword from the stunned Plouvis's belt and met the oncoming knight heiress head-on. Steel chimed on steel, and then the attacker shot on past Graham.
"Get on your feet!"
Graham roared. He spat as the snow and ice clouded his vision.
Get the girl! Get inside the walls!
Graham turned his body against the icy spray and shielded his palm against his side. Amara saw sudden fire kindle there, and Graham turned toward the second of the attackers and hurled a sudden roaring wall of flame back against the ice and snow. The attacker screamed, a horrible sound, and the gale abruptly vanished. Something black and heavy fell smoking into the snow before the gates, and the odor of charred meat filled the air. Amara dashed to Bernard's side, helping the steadholder to his feet. She didn't see the man who had attacked her until it was almost too late. He rose and drew a knife from his belt, eyes focused on her. With a flick of his wrist and a sudden pinpoint burst of air, the knife hurtled toward her, whistling with its raw speed. Bernard saw it too, and dragged her down, out of the path of the knife. It hit Graham in the lower back. Such was the force of the fury-assisted throw that Graham was hurled several paces forward into the snow. He went down at once, without so much as a cry or a gasp of pain, and lay still. Someone on the walls cried a command, and a pair of legionaries with bows loosed at the man at the base of the wall from almost directly above him. Arrows struck him hard, one in the thigh and one in back of the neck, its bloody tip emerging from the man's throat. He too fell into the snow, blood staining a quickly growing scarlet pool around him. "Where's the other one?" Amara demanded. She stood and swept her eyes over the sky. She barely saw, from the corner of her eye, another flickering of light and air, but when she focused on it, it was gone. Tentatively she sent Cirrus out toward it, but her fury found nothing, and after questing about aimlessly for a few moments, Amara gave up the effort. "It's no good," she whispered. "He got away." Bernard grunted and rose to his feet, one leg held stiffly, his face twisted with pain.
"Graham."
They turned to see Pluvis and several legionaries hovering over Graham's form in the snow. The truth-finder's face was pale.
"Healer!" he screamed. "Someone get the healer! The Count is hurt! Get the healer!"
Legionaries stood around him, stunned, staring. Amara let out a hiss of frustration and grabbed the nearest soldier.
"You," she said. "Go get the healer, now."
The man gave a nod and sprinted off.
"You,"
Pluvis said, his face twisted with distress, anger, and fear.
"I don't know who those men were, or what is going on, but you must be in on it. You came here to hurt the Count. This is your fault."
"Are you mad?" Amara demanded. "Those men were the enemy. You have got to get this garrison ready to fight."
"You cannot order me about like some kind of common slave woman," shouted Pluvis. "Centurion," he snapped, eyes watering but with his voice ringing with authority. "You all saw what happened. Arrest these two and take them to the cells on charges of murder and treason against the crown."
Chapter 30. Despite her exhaustion, Isana could not sleep. She spent the night holding Odiana's head in her lap, monitoring the woman's fever, with little else she could do for her. Pale light came through chinks in the walls of the smokehouse when a grey winter dawn rose over Cordholt. Isana could hear animals outside, men talking, crude laughter. Despite the cold air drifting in from without, the interior of the smokehouse remained broiling, the ring of coals around the two women glowing with sullen heat. Her throat, parched before, began to simply ache, agonizing, and at times it felt as though she could not get enough air into her lungs, so that she swayed and had trouble sitting up. Once, when Odiana tossed restlessly, Isana rose and went to the far side of the ring of coals. Her head spinning with heat and thirst, she gathered her skirts and made to step over the coals, a short leap to the far side. Even though she knew the door would be locked and bolted, there might be a loose board in the wall, or something she could use as a weapon in order to make an attempt at escape. Even as she lifted her foot, though, the ground on the far side of the coals stirred, and the swift, heavy form of Cord's fury rose up from the ground, misshapen and hideous. Isana's breath caught in her throat, and she lowered her foot again. The malformed fury subsided and sank slowly back into the earth. Isana clenched her fists in her skirts, frustrated, then moved back over to Odiana and took the woman's head onto her lap again. In her sleep, the collared woman whimpered and stirred languidly, her eyes rolling beneath their lids as she dreamt. Once she let out a pathetic cry and flinched, and her hand spasmed toward the collar. Even in the woman's dreams, it appeared, Cord's collar continued its assault on her senses, her will. Isana shuddered. The light waned, shadows shifting over the floor by infinitely slow degrees. Isana let her head fall forward, her eyes closed. Her stomach turned and twisted with worry. Tarvi and Bernard and Fade. Where were they? If they were alive, why hadn't Bernard followed her here? Had the ones attacking them been too much for her brother to handle? Bernard would never allow her to remain in Cord's hands. Not while he lived. Could he be dead? Could the boy be dead as well? Surely he'd escaped ahead of the flood.
Surely he had evaded anyone who may have pursued him even after. Surely.
Isana shook, and gave no voice to the sobs that racked her. No tears would fall. Her body had hoarded back all the moisture it could. She longed for the freedom to weep, at least. But she did not have it. She drifted that way, head bowed, sweltering and dizzy, and thought of Bernard and of Tavi. The grey of twilight was in the air when the bolt at the door rattled and Arik entered. He held a tray in his hands and he did not lift his face toward Isana. Instead, he walked to the circle of coals and stepped over, setting the tray down. There were two cups on the tray, nothing more. Isana looked steadily up at Arik. He rose and stood there for a moment, shifting his weight from foot to foot, his eyes down. Then he said, "Snow's starting up again. Heavier." Isana stared at him and said nothing. He swallowed and stepped back out of the ring of coals. He went to the hod of coal and began scooping out buckets again, to spread them over the smouldering ring, fresh fuel. "How is she?" he asked. "Dying," Isana said. "The heat is killing her." Arik swallowed. He dumped out a bucket of coals onto the ring, spilling some out sloppily, and went for more. "The water's clean, at least. This time." Isana watched him for a moment and then reached for one of the cups. She lifted it to her mouth and tasted, though it was all she could do not to start gulping frantically. The water was cool, pure. She had to steady herself with a deep breath and hold the cup in both shaking hands. She drank slowly, giving each sip time to go down. Isana only allowed herself half the cup. The rest she gave to Odiana, half hauling the woman into a sitting position and urging her to drink slowly, which she did with a listless obedience. She looked up to see Arik watching her, his face pale. Isana lowered the collared woman back down and brushed a few loose strands of hair back from her neck. "What is it, Arik?"
"They're coming tonight," he said. "My father. They're going to finish the Odiana and then put the collar on you."
Isana swallowed and couldn't stop the chill that went down her spine.
"After dinner," Arik said. He slopped more coals down. "It's like a celebration for him. He's handing out wine."
"Arik," Isana said, "it isn't too late to do something."
Arik pressed his lips together.
"It is," he said. "There's only one thing left now."
Without speaking, he finished carelessly dashing coals onto the ring of fire around them. Cord's entrance was presaged by a low tremble in the floor of the smokehouse. Then the big steadholder banged open the door with one fist and stepped inside, glowering. Without a word, he cuffed Arik's head, hard enough to stagger the younger man against the wall.
"Where is that tar, boy?"
Arik left his head down, his body held in a crouch, as though expecting to be hit again.
"I haven't got it done yet, Pa."
Cord sneered at him, placing his fists on his hips. Isana noticed the drunken sway to his balance as he did.
"Then you can just get it done while the rest of us eat. And if you fall off the crow's-eaten roof in the dark, that's your own affair. Don't go crying to me about a broken leg."
Arik nodded.
"Yes, Pa."
Cord growled something beneath his breath and then turned to Isana.
"Better get that other glass of water before my new whore figures out it's there."
Odiana let out a soft noise, curling in on herself. Cord watched her with a smirk on his face. Isana saw the ugly glitter in his eyes as he prepared to speak again and interrupted him.
"Cord, she's nearly dead as it is. Leave her be."
Cord narrowed his eyes at Isana, lips lifting away from his teeth. He took a lurching step closer to her.
"Still giving orders," he murmured. "We'll see. Tonight, after I'm done with that one, we'll see what it's like. We'll see who gives the orders and who takes them."
Isana met his eyes steadily, though his words made her heart thud with dull, exhausted fear. "You're a fool, Cord," she said.
"What are you going to do about it, huh? You're nothing, no one. What are you going to do?"
"Nothing," Isana said. "I won't have to. You've already destroyed yourself. It's just a matter of time now."
Cord flushed red and took a step toward Isana, his hands clenching into fists.
"Pa," Arik said. "Pa, she's just talking. She's just trying to get to you. It doesn't mean anything."
Cord rounded on Arik and swept his fist at him in a clumsy swat. Arik didn't dodge the blow so much as he let it catch his shoulder and throw him to the floor.
"You,"
Cord growled, chest heaving.
"You don't tell me. You don't talk to me. Everything you got because I gave it to you. You will not disrespect me, boy."
"No, sir," Arik said quietly.
Cord got his breathing under control and shot Isana another glare.
"Tonight,"
he said.
"We'll see."
The ground shook again as he turned and lumbered out. Coals sizzled in silence for a few moments. Then Isana turned to Arik and said,
"Thank you."
Arik flinched at the words, more than he had from his father's blows.
"Don't thank me," he said. "Don't talk to me. Please."
He gathered himself to his feet and picked up the bucket.
"Still have to lay out the tar. The ice didn't stick to the roof, but I have to tar it tonight or he'll feed me to the crows."
"Arik," Isana began.
"Be quiet,"
Arik hissed. He shot a glance at the door, then said to Isana,
"Snow's starting up again."
He left, and bolted the door behind him. Isana frowned at him, trying to puzzle out his meaning. She took the second cup of water and took a bit more for herself, then gave the rest to the semi-conscious Odiana. Outside the wind rose. She heard men moving around the steadhold. One of them walked past the smokehouse and banged on the walls, letting out a few crude phrases. Odiana flinched and whimpered. More raucous talk and rough laughter went up from somewhere nearby, probably the Steadholt's great hall. What sounded like a fight broke out, ending in cheers and jeers, and all the while it grew darker until only the red coals gave any light to the smokehouse's interior. There came a bang against the wall, wood against wood, then steps, feet on a ladder. Someone set down a weighty object on the roof and then hauled himself onto it.
"Arik," Isana called quietly.
"Shh,"
said the young man.
"This is the one other thing."
Isana frowned, staring up. She followed his weight as he moved from the edge of the slightly sloped roof up toward its crown, directly over the circle. Without warning, the naked blade of a knife sprang through the shingles, dropping bits of tar-stained wood and droplets of water in. The blade twisted left and right, opening a larger hole. Then it withdrew again. Arik proceeded around the roof slowly, and Isana could hear him slopping tar from a bucket he must have carried down onto the roof. But every moment or so, the knife would sink in again, opening a small hole between shingles. Then it would withdraw. He repeated the action several times, and then without a word he clambered down from the roof again. His feet crunched through snow and into the night. It only took a few moments for Isana to realize what Arik had done. The interior of the smokehouse was smoldering hot, and its heat rose up to the roof above and warmed the materials there. No ice had stuck to the roof the night before, Arik had said, but if the roof hadn't been sealed properly, swelling of the shingles and beams would set in after they had been soaked. They would have to be sealed immediately in order to prevent leaks, especially if the construction had been slipshod to begin with. The roof would require fresh tar consistently to keep it closed against leaks. Against water. Droplets began to fall through the holes Arik left with his dagger. Water that pattered to the floor, first in the occasional drop, and then, as the snowfall evidently increased, in a small, steady trickle. Water,
Isana's heart suddenly thudded with excitement, with hope. She leaned forward, across the ring of coals, and caught the nearest trickle of water in one of the empty cups. It filled in perhaps a minute, and Isana lifted it to her mouth and drank deeply, water coursing into her with a simple animal pleasure. She filled the cup again and drank, and again, and then gave more to Odiana as well. The collared woman stirred at the first cup and then more at the second. Finally, she was able to whisper,
"What is happening?"
"A chance," Isana said. "We've been given a chance." Isana reached across to fill both cups again as the trickle came down a bit more steadily. She licked her lips and looked around the circle of coals, searching for what she thought would be there. There, where Arik had slopped the coals in a particularly careless fashion. A spot where no fresh coals had landed, and only old grey, soft-edged coals remained. Trembling with excitement, Isana reached out and poured the water over the coals. They sizzled and spat. She refilled the glasses and did it again, and a third time, a fourth. With a final sputtering hiss, the last of the coals went out. Shaking, Isana caught another cupful of water and reached out through it for her fury, for Rill. The cup stirred and quivered, and abruptly Isana felt Rill's presence within the water, a quivering life and motion swirling within it frantically. Isana felt tears springing to her eyes, and a moment later felt Rill gently easing them back from her, felt the Fury's affection and relief at being in contact with her again. Isana looked up to Odiana, who had leaned out to catch another trickle of water in both cupped hands, and who had a distant, dreamy smile upon her face.
"They're talking about us," Odiana murmured. "So many cups. They're going to use me until the heat has killed me. Then it will be your turn, Isana. I think..."
She broke off suddenly, her back arching with a little gasp, then flung the water away from her, shaking her head and clapping her hands over her ears.
"His voice! No, I don't want to hear him. Don't want to hear him!"
Isana turned to her and caught her by the wrist.
"Odiana," she hissed, "we have to get out of here."
The dark-haired woman stared up at Isana, her eyes wide, and nodded.
"I don't know. I don't know if I can."
"The collar?" She nodded again.
"It's hard to think of doing things that wouldn't please him. I don't know if I can do them. And if he speaks to me..."
Isana swallowed. Gently she drew Odiana's hands down from her ears and then placed her own over them. "He shan't," she said quietly. "Let me." Odiana's face paled, but she nodded once. Isana reached out for Rill and sent the fury down through her touch into Odiana's body. Rill hesitated, once within, refusing to respond. Isana had to focus with a sharp effort of will before Isana's senses pressed through and into the other woman. Odiana's emotions nearly overwhelmed her. Tension, terrible fear, rage, frantic and near mindless, all of them trapped beneath a slow and steady pleasure. A languid pulse that radiated out of the collar, threatening at any moment to reverse itself into unspeakable agony. It was like standing within the heart of a storm, emotions and needs spinning past, whirling by. Nothing steady, nothing to orient upon. With a slow shudder, Isana realized that Rill had let her touch only lightly upon the water witch's emotions, on the frantic whirl and spill of them in her mind. She realized that Rill had meant to protect her from exposure to what could all too easily spill over into her own thoughts, her own heart. Isana frantically pushed that storm of the soul away from her, struggled to focus on her purpose. Through the fury, she sought out the other woman's ears, the sensitive eardrums. With a sharp, nearly frantic effort, she altered the pressures of Odiana's body within her ears. Distantly, Isana heard Odiana let out a pained gasp, and then the drums burst, another explosion of pain and wild emotions, glee and revulsion and impatience predominant. Isana withdrew her presence from the watercrafter as quickly as she could, jerking her hands and her face away. Even after the